All right. I hope everybody had a nice weekend. Hope everybody had a nice Shabbos. And looking forward to our learning again each week as I do. All right. So we're going to pick up and continue from what we started last week. There was a lot of excitement, a lot of interest, a lot of conversation, and a lot of nuances to the question that we started. And we started learning together in these classic contemporary cases in Shas. And when we say they're classic contemporary cases in Shas, is that what we have that we learn together is here is a question that's asked, and how does Shas deal with it? Meaning, how did the Poskim deal with it? How does the Gemara deal with it? Not only is it just, clinical, is it Shulchan Aruch, is it academic, but it's also, of course, very emotional. And as we see in this case, whereas typically halacha isn't emotional, what you wonder is, what is the din? Does the din in Shulchan Aruch take into consideration how you feel about something, or is it just like black and white? And usually it's very black and white. But in this case that we were discussing, we see that there's maybe an area of gray. So just to review a little bit that we started with the case that we had last week. Again, there was a fellow who survived the camps, and he survived the camps with his pair of tzitzis that was made with great mesiras nefesh. And when it was made with great mesiras nefesh, it means with great, superhuman heroic effort. And it was superhuman heroic effort that was not only recognized by this fellow, but of course the hundreds, or now he says thousand people that put on the tefillin, the tzitzis every single day, because they didn't have the talis kotan. They didn't have the ability to put on a tzitzis every day. And the thousand people that came, they would get up very early before the Nazis would come and stop them. And so now the fact that he survives the war and he has this tzitzis now, they are, of course, at this point, very worn out. The question, of course, then becomes if it's just that they were spun by and woven by, and if they were put together the strings by a person who was an amateur, and they're worn out. So what would be better, to use these tzitzis that were made with great mesiras nefesh, with great effort and great energy, versus a person has an opportunity to just go online and buy a pair of tzitzis that are what we call mahudr. And if they're mahudr, if they're enhanced, so maybe it should be better. So as we were learning last week, what difference should it make? Should it matter where what's considered the hiddur? What's considered the enhancement? Is the enhancement from who it came from? Is it the fact they were made in such an extraordinary way that should trump the statistic mahudr, that it was made by, somebody who was a Yirei Shemayim in the cases that, Linda, you referenced last week, or that the fact of the materials being better materials, which one takes precedence? And there's a lot of different layers here. The first layer that we have to unpackage is, when do we ever take into consideration the feelings that a person might have for something? That's number one. The second thing we take into consideration is just the difference between what Mesiras Nefesh means and how do you constitute what Mesiras Nefesh is. Is Mesiras Nefesh, is that an objective concept? Is it subjective? Obviously, the difference here is would be that if it was kosher versus not kosher, and if it wasn't kosher, there's nothing to talk about. But the fact that the tzitzis are kosher clearly indicates that, then on some level, even though they're not the best, but nonetheless, they're still significant and they're kosher in that fulfillment point of view. So then, clearly, it's a conversation to have. Okay, so that's the case we have before us. Just to review it quickly, and now we're going to jump into a little bit more of the matter with regards to the response of the literature associated. Okay, so that's under the section called tshuva. Tshuva means, and we all of course associate tshuva with repentance, but tshuva means here the response. Here's the answer. So look at the bottom, towards the bottom of the page. The Nemar b'Maseches Yuma, the Gemara now that we refer to is the Gemara Maseches Yuma. And that Gemara is the reference that we're going to now start with to see how to answer this question. So Nemar b'Maseches Yuma, Daf Lamed Ches Amud Aleph, folio 38 on the first page. And the Gemara there tells the story, Kishaholach Nikanor. Who is Nikanor? Now the Gemara Maseches Tainis also discusses who is Nikanor. We know that one of the gates in the in Yerushalayim, the Beis Hamikdash, entry into the Beis Hamikdash was Shar Nikanor. We have Shar Tzion, Shar Yafa, the various gates. And one of the names of the gates is Shar Nikanor. Nikanor is the name of a person. So at that time, the Gemara explains that there were very expensive and beautiful gates that were made in Egypt, in Mitzrayim, interesting. And that's also a fascinating part of this, which is we know there's a command that a person's not allowed to go back to Mitzrayim. So how is he able to go back to Mitzrayim? If there's a chiyuv to stay away from going to Egypt, B'vadya Yosef has a famous tshuva about what that means. We'll get to that hopefully maybe at another time. So he says, the Gemara explains, Kishahalach nikna l'mitzrayim l'havi dalsos mirachsandria. He went to get doors. There were special doors. You know, people, they renovate their homes, they renovate their offices. They want to go to they don't want to just go to Home Depot. They want to get the best doors. So he understood this is the Beis HaMikdash we're talking about here. So he wanted to get the doors from Alexandria in Egypt. So he went there. What does that mean? That on his way back from Alexandria, he had the doors, and there was a very tumultuous storm that threatened the ship to break up and for them to drown. Chalila v'chas. So that was the case. Not that he was on his way there, but on his way back. So what did he do? They surmised that maybe because of the fact that they had too much cargo, too much luggage, that they're going to lighten the load. And by lightening the load, maybe that would put them in a less of a precarious situation. And so therefore, they wouldn't be in this circumstance where they could possibly drown. So natlu achas mehen, so what did they do? They had two doors. So they decided they're going to throw overboard one of the doors. So they threw one of the doors into the water. What does that mean? And even though they threw one of the doors into the water, so the rage of the storm, it didn't subside. It's interesting. Like they thought, is it just a function of the storm was going to subside, or that they were going to be less in danger because, you know, they didn't think they were going to capsize? But it doesn't matter. The ocean did not stop from its tumultuous storming. So what happens? So they asked him, here's what they have to do. Throw the next one. You know, you threw the first board over. You threw the first door over. So now you got to throw the second one over because the situation is not better. So Nicanor was unwilling to do that. The first one he was willing to do over because he thought maybe that's what's going to be. But to give up both of these doors, doors that are precious, that should be brought to the Beis HaMikdash, that's not going to happen. So Amad Nicanor Vikarcha. So Nicanor, he decided it's not happening, and he held on to them very tight. He hugged them very, very tight. Fourth line. V'amar lahem hatiluni ima. He says, you know what? You can throw it in, but I'm going in with it. I'm going to hold on to it tight. Throw me in. I'm going to hold on to it tight. Throw me in with the board, with the door, rather. V'amar lahem hatiluni ima. Miyad. So from the just immediacy after he said that, his willingness to be thrown in together with that door, miyad nachaya mizafo. What happened? The Gemara explains that right away the violent storm subsides, calms down. Now, what happens? So Kivan shegia lenamolish shel Akko. When he came to the port at Akko, so haisa mivatseves v'yoytza delas shehitilu liyam. So there was a door that was protruding. Right, he got there to the port in peace and safety, but he saw that there was a door. Mitachas daif nesvina. He saw that underneath the walls of the boat there was a door, which was the first door that he threw overboard, and he saw that it was like bobbing in the water and it was protruding. It was able to be seen from the water, and it was tachas daif nesvina underneath the walls of the boat. And so, therefore, lefichach kol hasha'arim. So we see that there's a miracle that happened with these doors. These are famously miraculous doors. So lefichach, the Gemara explains, lefichach, this is all the Gemara. Lefichach kol hasha'arim shahayu b'mikdash. That it's interesting. In all the gates in the Beis HaMikdash, so when all of the gates nishtanu lios shel zahav, they did an upgrade in the Beis HaMikdash. You know, you have a house, you do renovations, you have a Beis HaMikdash, you have a synagogue, you have a holiest of all synagogues. They did an upgrade, and then all of the gates in the Beis HaMikdash, they decided to be Nishtana Lios Zahav. They decided they're going to make them all of gold. But there was one set of doors that they did not trade in the status. They didn't upgrade. So this is Kol HaShe'arim Shai B'Mikdash Nishtana Lios Kol Zahav Chutz Mishari Niknar. But they left them as copper. They were copper doors. They left them as they were. Mipnei Shenaso Bonisim, because Nisim, miracles happened with these doors. There was a certain level of holiness that even trumps the gold. Ad kan lashono. Now, ad kan lashono means that's the Gemara. That's what the Gemara says. Now, here's what's interesting. Vanisim harenasu biglal hamesiris nefesh shel niknor. Why did this miracle happen? So the commentary on this Gemara is that the miracle happened for one reason and one reason only. That was because of and measured by the mesiris nefesh, the incredible heroic effort of niknor. That effort was shehu shava shoyser mizahav. That's considered even greater than zahav, than gold. That the effort that you have. So here's the super Herculean effort, and then there's the gold. So even though it might be like considered to be a material that's on the highest and higher level, it doesn't matter. Vegam so too. Kisha aimdim lekayim zekeli vanveyu. Now we have a precept, a concept. From the Pasuk in Chumash, Zekeli Vanvei. What's Zekeli Vanvei? Zekeli Vanvei is we want to beautify the mitzvah, right? That we extrapolate from that word, those words that we want to beautify the mitzvah. That's why we get a beautiful pair of tefillin, a beautiful esrog. We want to get a beautiful sukkah. We want to do the mitzvahs in a beautified and most enhanced way. And even those people will say Zekeli Vanvei, and that way that one would be able to fulfill this idea, Zekeli Vanvei, by making it such that these gates were no different than the other gates. Let's suppose so Zahav, and by doing so, you dip it in gold, or you create the upgrade like you did the other doors. Amrinan, we say you should know Shanisim Gedolim Yosem Zahav. Miracles is even greater than gold. And so therefore, what we're going to do is we're going to identify there seems to be a pecking order, a level of what's more important than something else, depending on what it is. And not only depending on what the material is, but depending on how the material was achieved, was received, was experienced. So since there was a level of miracle nisim, the fact that they were copper and a lower material status level than gold, then it doesn't matter. Because this last line, these last four words, why? Shehanisim gedolim yoser mizahav. Because the miracles that happened to these gates, to these doors, in general, you should know Yosem Mizahav is considered greater than even gold. Okay? So this is what's set up this way. Top paragraph. V'ulai, and we'll take questions in a minute because things are going to get interesting here in a minute. V'ulai kach be'inyonenu. So here he explains that so too, maybe in our learning here, maybe our topic that we've been discussing, again, whether it's better Mesiris Nefesh, tzitzis made, tied Mesiris Nefesh versus buying them with a status of enhancement, the mesiras nefesh shel asiyas tzitzis, maybe the amount of Herculean effort that was used to tie, to find, to weave, to spin tzitzis in the camps, it's odif. Maybe it's considered odif. What's odif? It's preferred. Ulai mitalis noev, it's tzitzis yofim. Even from a talis, meaning the beged, the actual garment itself, which is beautiful, it's nicer material, and the tzitzis are yofim, are objectively better. The fact that they're objectively better, even though you seem to, in halacha, have an obligation to choose things that are objectively better, maybe not. Maybe if there's nisim or mesiras nefesh that are associated with it, it means that even though there's something that's objectively better, it seems though that it has a preference. And here he brings an interesting example. And this is a Shulchan Aruch example. So now we've extended ourselves to this morning learning not only Shas, but we also, whenever you learn Shas, whenever you learn Sugyas in the Talmud and the Gemara, we have to also understand how we bring it down in Halacha. In fact, the correct way to learn a Sugya in a Gemara is to learn what the Rambam says, to learn what the Shulchan Aruch in Yoredei and Choshen Mishpat, to understand what Nor HaChaim, the Shulchan Aruch, tells us, the Mishnah Brura, to understand how this is applicable in our lives based on Psukim and Chumash, because that's basically the source. So here he explains there's a biblical source and a certainty in ruling of a halach and Shulchan Aruch. How do we know that this might be? V'ulai, second sentence, V'ulai, ze atam shechaviv, that we have, maybe this is the reason why, chaviv is odif mishivas haminim. Now, that's a sentence. Now, we have to understand what that phrase means. First of all, the idea is, we know there's a word. The word is called chaviv. But we're using it as an idea. There's the word as it's translated, and then there's the word as it's being used in the context of an idea. Chaviv means it's cherished, it's beloved, right? So it's something that you like and it's something that you love. So if it's chaviv to you, it's even preferred. It's beloved. So adif means that it's preferred. So we see that when is it that something that's beloved to you is preferred? Why should something, the fact that you love it more, should it be preferred? doesn't mean, let's just say you just love, you love putting on your tefillin so much. So I should prefer to put on my tefillin before my talis? The answer is no, because halacha tells me that tadr v'she'enu tadr kodim requires me to put on my talis first. So what are we? So maybe there are exceptions to that rule. Clearly there are. So this is maybe there's a reason why that which is chaviv to you, that which is precious to you, it's adif, it's preferred. Mishivas aminim. What's shivas aminim? So this is an example, one that Shulchan Aruch gives as one of its examples. We know the pasuk tells us in Chumash that there are certain food items that are established as ones that give praise to Eretz Yisrael, right? Now, lamaros shabam, even though there are those amongst them that mishabeach, that praise that are associated with the praise of Israel, of Eretz Yisrael, right? Rimon, Zayit. We know the Shivas Aminim, right? So because of the Shivas Aminim, so what happens if you have before you a plate? Now we're going to be this Thursday welcoming the month of Shvat, and on the 15th is going to be Tu B'Shvat, and we're going to have, for some, we're going to have a Tu B'Shvat order, Tu B'Shvat Seder. And typically we have a Seder of fruits and vegetable fruits from Eretz Yisrael. So if you have an order, so if you have, again, as I mentioned, I think last time, an apple, or if you have a grape, or even apple and a rimon, you then make the bracha on that which is of the Shiva Saminim, of those which are used to praise Eretz Yisrael, because obviously it's adif, it's mentioned in the Chumash. Now what happens if there's something that's chaviv to you, that's even more important than that which is mentioned in Eretz Yisrael? Shulchan Aruch rules that b'chol zos, even though nonetheless, chaviv, adif, that even though you would maybe otherwise think that a pasuk in Chumash, which identifies specific food items which give praise to our beloved Eretz Yisrael, no. Even though, all things being equal, that's where the rule is a rule. But if things are not equal and there's something that's more precious to you in the sense it's preferred to you, it's beloved to you, you love it more, so it's chaviv. Why? Now this is very important. Biglal ha-misragshos, because a person is going to have a regesh. Sarakshus means he's going to feel it more. Now, one could argue if there's an answer that will allow you to eat an apple that's not one of Echad Meshiva Saminim before a Rimon, it's because of his Sarakshus. What's his Sarakshus? You're going to feel it more. And this is mentioned in the Mishnah Berurah and Shulchan Aruch as well. Why is this so? Maybe you could argue that I should be able to put my talis on second, my tefillin on first, because I have hisrakshus. Is there a danger in saying that because I have a regish, I could do it first and foremost? Maybe, maybe not. Clearly here in Shulchan Aruch, the answer is that it's not a danger. I guess there's parameters to this. And one of the reasons that maybe that it's adif because of hisrakshus, which means that chaviv, what you find pleasing, pleasurable, more meaningful, more tasty, is hisrakshus. Maybe the fact that you're going to make a bracha is going to be more enhanced. You're going to have more connection to it. You're going to have more feeling, more kavana, more fervor. It's going to be more meaningful to you. So here it's interesting, just that's an interesting halacha. And not everybody follows this, but again, it's a Mishnah Berurah, so that's as informative and as authoritative as can be. So kach, last sentence, I'll open up a little bit. Kach, gam in yonenu. So too, maybe it seems that in our topic as well, hachavivos, that which is beloved, chavivos, biglala mesiris nefesh adifam mitalis noe. So we see that maybe, could be, that which was spun, woven, tied with mesiris nefesh is no different. It's like, it's chaviv, it's precious to you. If it's precious to me, then it's even maybe adifa, it's adif from even that which is a talis noe. Now, if you look in the notes on the bottom, you see that little aleph? If you look in the bottom of the page, I think maybe Jason made it that it's in the middle of the page on the copies. You see where it says Nemar? So in there, that's like a little aleph. Here he gives another example. And because the more you make your case, the more examples that you bring to make your case, the stronger the argument. So that's what happens in the footnotes here. If you look at the footnotes, there's just another example of where we see something that's precious and beloved. We act differently towards it. Nemar gamba bikurim. We see that, what's the bikurim? The bikurim that was brought to the Kohanim in the Beis HaMikdash, everybody brought bikurim. In the third chapter, if you look in the Mishnayis and the eighth Mishnah of Maseches Bikurim, so we see that there was a process. There was a very dramatic process. There were very great details associated with bringing the bikurim. the first fruits. But here's what's interesting. The Mishnah says, Sha'ashirim hayimivim bikureihem bikalsos shal zahav. That the wealthy ones would bring the bikurim in gold baskets because they're rich. Va'kohanim achzirum. You know what happened? The Kohanim would take the contents out of the basket and they would return the baskets back to the wealthy ones. V'ilu sali tzarim shel areva, shel arva reads. So there, but however, shiviu behem aniyem bikureihem hayu noitlem behem. But the reed baskets that were made of very simple materials that were woven, the Kohanim kept. Who wove those? Those were the aniyim, the poor people, the paupers. The paupers, they used raw materials. They didn't use gold. They used reeds. So it's interesting. The Kohanim would return the gold baskets of the wealthy ones, and they would keep the baskets of the poor ones. So that's this Mishnah. Now, second end of the second line. Because of Harav Rav Yehuda Naiman, so this Rabbi Naiman, who's quoted in this footnote, he explains, Haniim, the reason why, kefimiyut haksagas yadam, because of how little they can afford, because how little they had, hayumivim shel sal poshet. So since they had very little, they didn't have the luxuries to go out and buy fancy materials or to use fancy materials. So they made baskets that were very, very simple. Shel nitzarim shel also b'moyedayim. They used their hands. They made them themselves. They made them with humility and a sense of a broken heart. They did them with great sincerity, great genuine. It was very genuine. L'chein, similarly, Hashem Yisbarach Sheichin Daka, because we know that the Almighty lives with the lowly ones. V'shafal ruach. Now that doesn't mean to be, we're not talking about depressed and despondent, but humble. With anivus, that the Rebbein Shem lives with a person who lives with anivus, with humility, that he even reveals himself mitoy chasne, in the midst of a bush, not in this high, even when it was a revelation at Sinai, it was a low mountain. So lechein Hashem Yisbarach sheichin daka v'shofar ruach mich. So and therefore mechayvev min chazu. This is considered beloved. This basket of simplicity. It's better than gold. The baskets of the poor, as simple as they were, is considered chaviv, is considered preferred than even the baskets of gold. And so he says that maybe this is also true in our case, in our example as well. That here you have, this is not just in our case, but obviously maybe in all other cases, but certainly in our case that we're discussing, explains based on the Gemara in Maseches Yuma, the case of Nicanor, the case in Shulchan Aruch, the Mishnah Brura, the Shivas Haminim, and then the Mishnah in Bikurim, which here explains that there was very big difference between the baskets of the Inim and the baskets of the Ashirim. And that seems to be Gambi in Yoneinu Achavivus, the preferred, is Biglala Mesiris Nefesh Adifa Mitalis Noah. That in this case, and again, it could be in other cases, we could have to dissect and discuss other cases, but it could very well be that this is also something in other cases as well. But certainly for this case, the Mesiris Nefesh, how much effort and arduous activity put towards a certain activity means that it is preferred. Before we get to the last paragraph, any questions, comments, interests, concerns?
Yes, I do. I just want to say, I hear everything you're saying, but I think that I'm going to talk about the people who had money and then their gold baskets were returned. Just they brought it with their whole hearts, probably feeling like this was very special. And I'm not sure that they deserve to have that feeling taken away, that they gave it with a full heart too. Maybe they didn't have the skills or whatever their story was. And then the people who have less money, I understand they gave it with a full heart as well. So I feel like there's so many loopholes in all these presentations that it's almost like if you can make enough of a case for your sentiments and how you did it, not just the effort of the act, that maybe anyways almost sounds like it would be okay. I know that's not right, but I'm just saying how it presents to me.
No, good. But listen, that's what we have to learn together. We have to learn together. So a couple comments. So I appreciate your question very, very much.
And also, I would think that it seems to me that what each person has is the most important to them. The doors didn't mean anything. Pardon?
Yeah, I agree. That's true. That's true.
Right. The doors didn't mean anything to the other people on the ship. The importance of the doors were to the person who went for them. I believe that sometimes we say beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. It has to do what's most important to you, and it's difficult to judge how somebody else acts according to what they do. Does that make sense?
Very much so. So a couple comments. Excellent. Both of you, excellent questions. So the first things we have to understand is that we learn a topic, halacha. Part of what we're thinking about is in a situation where you had to make a choice, you had to make a decision. How do you make your decision? And part of, even though there is so many things that go and weigh into the consideration, our goal is to figure out what is the thinking process that we have to, consider to making whatever that decision is, whether it's talis and tefillin, whether it's challah and grape juice, whether it's, honoring mother or father first. I mean, there is a system and a mechanism and just the critical thinking that's necessary. That's number one. And obviously it goes without saying, you're 100% right. And why the Mishnah doesn't address this, we're going to get to this in a second statement, but you're 100% right. A person could give a gold basket and have all of the same levels of shoychein daka, v'shafa ruach, like a humility, a humbleness of them. And they're giving of the best of what they have because, look, they have the best of what they have to offer. It's great. They shouldn't be punished because they're wealthy, right? They're actually a good number of Amorayim in the Gemara, Rava being one of them, was very wealthy. And the fact that you can, because that you're wealthy is not a punishment. The fact that you can give of your wealth, it doesn't mean that you don't have the possession of those things that would be deserved, that just like a poor person's basket would be accepted, so his basket should likewise be accepted, right? So let's be very clear that there are always exceptions and there are always definitions. A person who's wealthy gives a gold basket, his basket could be even greater than the person who is the poor person whose basket is a simple basket, and he didn't make it with a humility. He made it with a gaiva, he made it with an arrogance, right? So you never can really say that all things are equal to all people, right? And I want to be always very careful to make sure that we make that point, which is, again, the wealthy person can have the wrong intentions, good. The poor person can have the good intentions, good. The wealthy person can have the right intentions and the poor person can have the wrong intentions. It goes without saying. But part of what's very important in general, and again, whenever you learn halacha, there's the general rule. And then you have to understand like where it applies to individuals, where it applies to a community. And there are differences. And the differences are that flexibility areas that are sometimes gray and sometimes misunderstood by large swaths of people. But you have to understand that part of what it is the way we refer to the Torah is a Toras Chaim. What is Toras Chaim? Toras Chaim means it's the living Torah. What does it mean, the living Torah? Living Torah means that we're not angels and we're not robots. And it would almost be easier if we were robots than if we were angels, because then here's what I got to do. And this is the law. It's black and white. And what it is. And for the most part, it really is black and white. But there are also exceptions and nuances and personalities and applications of every bit of every section of Torah law with appropriate information that has to be provided. So we know that, for example, you cannot be mechallel the Shabbos, period, hard stop. Unless it's pikuach nefesh. You cannot absorb, you can't violate the Shabbos unless it's the seventh day of a baby's birth. It wasn't cesarean and it was born on Shabbos without it being at a time of suffix, a time of doubt. So it's those are just like two basic, obvious examples of so many areas in halacha. So the general rule is, I guess, this mission is assuming that the likelihood of a person being arrogant when he has is so much so that the rule was that the Kohanim did not take it. Was that fair? Maybe there are times that the Kohanim did take it. I'm sure there was. And the general rule is that a person who puts a lot of effort into doing it, it could very well be that that it's always the case that they always take the ones of the aniyim? Maybe not. I got to believe that that might not have necessarily been the case. And what we're going to understand is maybe there's a difference between the person who makes the tzitzis himself and works very hard to be sure to it that while he's in the camps, he's able to have tzitzis versus those who inherit the tzitzis. He passes away, gives it, you know, to his son, who gives it to his son. So several generations later of descendants have it. Maybe that Mesiris Nefesh is not the same status that they're able to then, with all things being equal, and you have a choice. So the choice is, it's true, beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. But in halacha, you have to make a decision. And how do we make a decision? What is the arbiter? It's not just that anything goes, because if anything goes, it would be total chaos. Today, yeah, sure, many times people take the liberty to think that as we study halacha, there's, you know, an Abaye and a Rava, there's a Shammai, and there's a Hillel, there's a Rav, and there's a Shmuel. You can find an answer. People go rabbi fishing constantly until they get an answer that they're satisfied with. People make that mistake all the time. But the reality is that that's not how it's supposed to be. We're supposed to stay faithful to what is your tradition, what is your Mesorah, what is your Minhag, who is your rabbi. And even if sometimes it's inconvenient, that's just the nature of the beast. That happens in the world of medicine, that happens in the world of legal counsel, that happens in the world of everything. We are constantly able to apply nuances to situations. And this is really part of what I call fascinating, a sea of possibility. And even though sometimes people say that Torah observant Judaism is so strict and there's so many rules, sure, there's lots of rules, but it's the Torah's Chaim that also opens its eyes to situations as they exist, not a violation of halacha, but a situation as it would exist, as it would present itself. Listen, I know we don't have to get into this now, but one of the hot button topics right now, I just got a text on a rabbi's chat, and I know this is going to be sent all around, so I'm saying this, you know, conscientiously. Whether or not, let's just assume, for example, for a moment, that the only time a vaccine would have been made available to you was on Shabbos. Are you allowed to take a vaccine on Shabbos? Or do you have to wait? Because there's a lot of violation associated. There's travel, there's the preparation, right? The actual zrika, the inoculation itself, according to Rav Poskim, is fine, but it's all the associated parts of it. If you can't get it on Shabbos, are you then not going to be able to get it? Again, these are just shilas that are coming up. So one could say, no, Shabbos, it's Shabbos. Answer is that we know that there's application of Jewish law that allow, whether it's a vaccine or, you know, again, that's a machlokas haposkim. How do we paskin today? These are things that are happening today and happening today in real time. But I think that, the questions are very, very good questions. But I think what's always important to keep in mind is that we don't look for ways to be lenient. We just look for ways to apply what the halacha is to our lives. And sometimes it's very specific. Sometimes it's very community specific. And sometimes it's Jewish people specific. Does that make sense, Carol, Linda? Push back. Feel free to push back. This doesn't have to be.
No, I mean, it makes sense. But I guess for me, like, I understand when you're talking about Shabbos or maybe the tefillin argument is a more important argument. But some of them seem like, and I apologize that I feel this way, doesn't matter if you eat a rimon before the apple. I mean, I know that you have a case for that. But there's some that are lighter. So I guess if somebody feels so strongly, even though the rabbi's like, you really should not use those tzitzis or something like that, that there's got to be a way that will help that person find a way to do it and not feel like, oh, there's an aveira. You know what I mean?
Right.
That's what I think I'm thinking.
So I don't know if it's an aveira. I think it's just like, what's the best way to be? You know, like, it's, do I think, again, the Ribbono Shel Olam, who wrote whose Torah it is, made the concept of a connection between certain foods and Israel. Now, why should that even be? Like, what the Tu B'Shvat Seder, like, why should even that exist? What's the purpose of any mitzvah for that matter? Any mitzvah, and even in the case of specific foods, like, does it really matter? Will you really feel closer to Israel with the foods that you eat? The answer is yes, actually. And all the Ribbono Shel Olam wants with every mitzvah, I believe, is for us to be closer to him. to feel more richly Jewish, to feel more mostly connected as best as we possibly can, right? So that's the purpose of every mitzvah. And even through foods that a person will eat, you're going to feel more connected to Israel. It might seem like, really, does God really, really care? The answer is that he wants us to care. And maybe there are things that we will feel differently if the laws were or were not in place the way they are. So I think that, you know, sure, it could be seen as like, it's not an avera. I don't like to use the word avera as, you know, that loosely. I look at it as that, whether it's, you can say things like missed opportunities or opportunities for even greater levels of closeness. When you bite into a rimon, I got to believe that you feel Rosh Hashanah. When you bite into a rimon or a date or a fig, and you realize that you're doing that on Tu B'Shvat because you want to connect to the love of land of Eretz Yisrael, you feel connected. You feel connected. How much more connected? Maybe a little less, a little more connected, a little less connected. I don't think the measured amount is not as significant as the concept, as the idea. It's not this is an avera. The question is, you have a choice. What do you do? How do you? We're presented with choices in halacha literally all the time. And the question is, which one would you choose? How do we make that choice? And the only purpose of making that choice is not that if you choose wrong, you have an avera, but there's you know, how much we can't do two things at once. There really is no difference between the example of Shiva Saminim and Talis and Tefillin. They're just another example of how do you make a choice. And the reason why in Shulchan Aruch, there's an example of why what is beloved and cherished to you maybe over, you know, override that which is in a chumash, is because the only reason why it's a certain way is that you should feel a certain way. And if you don't feel a certain way by doing it through the normal mechanism, or if you feel more so towards something about an apple, like you love an apple. So if you're going to feel closer and feel a greater level of, even if it's indiscernible, the amount of kavanah you're going to have, clarity of the words when you say the bracha, if it's going to bring you closer to Hashem, then that is the goal. That is the purpose. I actually find this to be very beautiful, because I think sometimes what happens is people just do things for the sake of doing things. And they forget to remember that the reason why we do things is to bring ourselves closer to God. And this is a perfect example. The Chumash says you have to do this first. Here's the pecking order. Yeah, but that pecking order is when all things are being equal. And you can't, you have an apple and you have a pomegranate in your hand. So you can't make a bracha on both of them. You have to have one specific thing that you're making a bracha on. It can cover the other one. So which one do you do? I make it on the pomegranate because it's one of the foods that are mentioned in relation to Eretz Yisrael. Good. But if I really, really love this apple greater than even the pomegranate, so the Shulchan Aruch says, I can do it. Why? Because if it's chaviv to you, you're going to feel more connected to making that bracha, and it's going to bring you closer to God. So we care about how you feel. And how you feel, not in the world of an avera. That's like very heavy. Unfortunately, there's so many schools that are so focused on raising children with the fear and the dread and the trepidation of an avera, an avera, an avera. I don't know. I mean, those are, of course, we worry about averas and sins and things like that, but it's very dark. It's very, very dark. It's very dark. What do you say?
I'm saying it makes sense to me. I mean, I understand what you're saying.
Okay, good. Linda, what do you think? Okay.
She's still thinking.
You know, there's a concept in Gemara called Shtika Kaheda. You know what that means?
I don't.
Shtika Kaheda means when you're quiet, you've accepted.
Okay.
I was muted. When we're in Leviticus, we talk about stumbling blocks, and all I hear every time we get come up with something, there's constantly stumbling blocks of everything we approach.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, we're always stumbling over, you do it this way, you do it that way, there's a right way, there might not be a right way. We put ourselves into all kinds of positions.
the proverbial halachic pretzel. The halachic pretzel. These are real live scenarios, real live cases. That's what Gemara is. That the Gemara is, well, when we say Yidavin Shachris, when do you daven Shachris? Yidavin Shachris 4 hours into the day, Yidavin 6 hours into the day, Milchiks and Fleshiks. How long do you wait between milchiks and fleishiks? Fleishiks and milchiks. I wait 6 hours. I wait into the sixth hour. I wait 3 hours. I wait however long it takes me to get from my dining room table to the refrigerator. Like, we got a whole host of, you know, when is Shabbos? Is it 18 minutes after candle lighting? Is it, you know, 40 minutes after Shabbos is after Shabbos? Like, that is the stumbling, the definition of a stumbling block is things that are placed before us that we unknowingly will probably trip and fall. But to understand how to navigate in a cave that's maybe a little bit dark is to figure out how to illuminate with a light that is going to bring light to how to understand what we have to do. Knowledge is power. And part of being a chacham, a wise person, is to just understand what the Shulchan Aruch tells us and what it means, not just that it's black and white, I've memorized every bit of it. It's not just necessarily to memorize it, it's to know how to apply it. You can be a doctor and know all of the medicine and all of the science, but if you don't know how to apply it, if you just say, okay, you need to have X number of milligrams for the refuah, for the healing of whatever your ailment is, and you don't take into consideration any of the other drugs, the other medications, the other circumstances, the other, you know, medical condition of the person in the totality, you could end up wounding somebody. So everything in life is a stumbling block. It's a navigation system. It's the halachic navigation system that we have to figure out. It's not as tidy and as nice as like a story, but it's the innuendos and the ins and outs of situations that are fascinating when you take into consideration how do we make decisions in Jewish law. What is a Gemara? A sugya and a Gemara is something simple like, you know, dancing in front of a kala at a wedding. The Gemara in Ksuva says, Ketzad Meraktin Lifnei Akala. Everybody heard that. You've heard those words before, right? We don't hear them we don't say them like a sugya. We say, Ketzad Meraktin Lifnei Akala, right? You know what those words mean? It doesn't just mean, okay, let's just go crazy and be like an ape in front of the chasen kala. It's actually quoting Gemara. What is Ketzad? How do we dance in front of a chasen and kala? How do you dance in front of a chasen kala? What is this? The Gemara's giving me dance lessons. So the Gemara says, it's a whole discussion. Do you say kala nava chasuda? Do you say that the kala, do you praise the kala for her beauty or not? Is it not stays to do that? What if she's not pretty? Are you allowed to lie to her? We have a concept, there's another pasuk in Chumash called Midvar Sheker Tirchad. You're not allowed to lie. You have to stay distant from telling a lie. So what do you do? Is that prohibited? It's again, everything, every single bit of how you talk to people, what you're allowed to say, what's considered Lashon Hara, what's considered Lashon Nekiyah, which Sefer Torah you take out of the Aron Kodesh, whether you put your talis and tefillin, which bracha you make, you know, first when you're at a Tuesday night dinner, do I make a mizonos and then an adama, and then I make a eitz, then I make a shahakol, or then do I mash? Every bit of it. It's complicated, complex, and glorious. And the way I describe the glory of it is that it's all about the intensity of opportunities in our relationship. So now, do I think that God cares if we cut the letters on Shabbos? No. But I think that God wants us to be in a relationship with him. I think God likes, wants, what does it mean God likes? God wants us to be close to him. And by remembering not to cut the letters is just another way of us being close to him. Not to be focused on the pedantic, the seemingly unnecessary details, but it's all in the details. Every relationship that's good or bad, it's all about the details. It's all about the details. The big stuff usually works. It's all about the details that makes all the difference in the world. So I'm going to stay out of Leviticus with you for the time being, Linda, till we get there.
Since yeah, that's fine.
When we get to Leviticus, Tova. It's going to be hot to trot. All right, let's just end this piece here because then we'll get a full topic here. Vigisi, Rav Chaim Kanievsky, his brother-in-law Rav Chaim Kanievsky says, "Server the talis katan muhudar im chutim hadara madifim." No, he says actually, even though we just ruled that the mesiris nefesh tzitzis seems to be bigger and better and more appropriate. No, Rav Chaim Kanievsky says that the talis katan, meaning the tzitzis, that have the that have the status of enhancement, that would be adif. Now, why is that? So he says, no, you can't bring a proof from Nicanor. You can't bring a proof from the story that we explained from the Gemara Maseches Yuma. Why? The gambli at Sipay Zahav Hem Hayu Yofim Elisha Zav Yofi Yosa. You know why? Because these were already good quality gates. These were already on a high level, right? He went all the way from Eretz Yisrael, traveled to Egypt, went to Alexandria, and he picked up these doors and he brought them back. The fact that they were, that there's gold that's even greater than copper, he says, you know, it's still Zekeli Van Veyu. Is there more Zekeli Van Veyu? Less Zekeli Van Veyu? He says that no, they're already considered on a higher level. But he does conclude, and this is where this piece ends, last line, ulam. So he says, perhaps ulam laosa adam. For this guy, it was his tzitzis that he made them, and he survived the war with them. Laosa adam shah says tzitzis. So he made the tzitzios b'mesiris nefesh. He made them with great Herculean superhuman effort. Ulai havalo maskeris mitzvah, because as a result of him wearing these mitzvahs, he's going to remember this mitzvah. He's going to feel connected to this mitzvah. V'lo atalas katan hazeh adif. That means for him, in this case, it means that this tzitzis is preferred. Whereas it might be for this guy and this guy alone, not his grandchildren, not his great-grandchildren, not somebody who would buy them. The fact that they are objectively, you know, made with this mysterious nefesh doesn't necessarily mean that anybody and everybody would be able to choose that. Maybe specifically for this guy, because he feels that connection. Now, could it be argued that you would feel that connection more, even though it's not your family? You bought it at Sotheby's, and buying it at Sotheby's meant that you have now this garment that was made with mysterious nefesh. You put it on and you feel differently. You could argue that. Maybe that would give you the license to be able to wear it, to be able to use it. But he explains here in this conclusion that Laosa Adam, that this guy and this guy alone, maybe he would be able to wear the tzitzis only because of the fact, Havilo Maskeris Mitzvah, because of how he's going to remember the mitzvah. Again, the whole purpose of why we do mitzvahs is to be able to bring ourselves close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to be able to feel a connection to the mitzvahs in a beautiful way. So I'm going to have a Maskeris Mitzvah. I'm going to be able to feel connected to the mitzvah differently. So then for him, velo, to him, Talis Katan Azeh, to him it's other. But to somebody else, it might not necessarily be the ruling. So it's just an interesting case of such a situation, what's considered best and what would be second best, where we see this applies in other areas as well. And of course, as with every case, you have to ask your local Orthodox rabbi to figure out what and how it applies to you and in which situation it's presented to you. All right, that ends this first piece. I hope you found it at least somewhat informative, if not frustrating, but also exciting.
I'm picking the frustrating one. That's my choice. No, only a little bit. Only because in the very last piece, when you did your summary, you said, perhaps, maybe the next generation, maybe they would still feel that way. And that's what I'm saying, that it's hard to know what's in somebody's heart, right? So
then I would say, this is what I would say to somebody who would ask this question. Really, the halacha is, if it was, there's somebody who, well, I'm pretty confident is going to listen to this recording later. And no, just because I know he listens to his recordings later. So he tells me the following. He has a talis that is like a family heirloom.
Right. Uh-huh.
Good. Multiple generations, Zaydi is Zaydi. That's whose talis it is. So he says he wears it on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, and he feels very, very different. So if a person truly feels very different, he's brought to tears, he feels connected, then obviously to that person, it seems to be that it would be a permissible thing. That person should be allowed to wear it, and that's what one should choose. But if a person just has it, not that they feel that thing, I mean, you have to be very honest about it. And if everybody's different. Some people are more of the emotional connection type. Some people are not. There's another fellow who I know, he inherited his grandfather's talis, and he feels that it's very yucky and it's smelly. And not only does it not make him feel good, it makes him feel bad. So everybody's different. So that means if all things being equal, I would tell a person really should choose the things that are mehudar, that's enhanced, that's the best possible, utensils, materials made in the best, most exquisite way. Okay, but we know that there is a situation where if it feels to you different, and as long as it's within the confines of halacha, then it's allowed. If I feel that I love Shabbos so much and I want to keep Shabbos on Sunday, that's ridiculous, because that Shabbos is not meant to be kept on Sunday. But if it was permissible, if it's kosher, if it's allowed, if it's halachic, and all things being equal, there's an enhancement and not an enhancement, so then it would be permissible, where all things being equal, better for a person to choose. That's why, the reason why it's ambiguous is because you can't make a halachic ruling like this without speaking to an individual person when both things are past the threshold of being permissible. If a person would otherwise not feel that way, you shouldn't use it. If you felt very, very strongly about it and you really were really enhanced your davening, you felt connected to this family member and you wore that garment and it felt so special to you, so then you'd have a halachic precedence to be able to do that. And that's the flexibility of the, see, people, as I mentioned, people think it's very, very much not flexible. It's inflexible, but it's very flexible. It depends on how it's applied. Not flexible in the sense that it's kosher treif, mutter usser, right? Permissible, not permissible. But it's flexible that under the auspices of what is in the mizgeret of permissible, so there's things that are better and that are not better. For one person, it might be better to do this. Another person, it might be better to do that. Chalav Yisrael, Chalav Stam, right? Mm-hmm. I've shared this example with you many, many times. You know, I keep Chalav Yisrael. My mother, for my birthday for many years, I never told my mother when I chose to be Chalav Yisrael at the very, very beginning, because I knew she liked to get me a birthday cake every year. That was OUD. So Chalav Yisrael is a minhug, and Kibbutz Avaim was a Doraisa. So I went with the Doraisa. If she got me a treif ham and cheese cake for my birthday, I won't eat it. But since it's kosher, so I chose Doraisa over a minhag, because that there's a permissibility to do it. Now, Jen used to always say, "Well, you don't have to eat the whole cake." She's like, "You have a piece. You don't have to relish in that. That would be a little much. I could be like, tell me for a couple of days." Anyway, good. My bracha is that we should just find satisfaction, happiness, and joy. And I really appreciate everyone's feedback and questions.